hear the music, Robert. Yes, I can.
I'll never turn to the dark side.
What's your favorite scary movie?
What's the boogeyman?
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
I am the father. Enter the Mont Blanc.
I live in Notting Hill, you live in Beverly Hills.
Who are you?
I'm your Uncle Buck.
They tell me you want to be a picture maker.
Can you introduce me as Joker?
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Phil at the Movies. Now, there are teen films, teen comedies, if you will, and then there are films. 10 Things I Hate About You is most certainly the latter. Smart, funny, charming, and all around sweet. This comedy borrows heavily from Taming of the Shrew. In fact, it's a perfect modern adaptation of the Shakespeare classic, with enough sensibilities to fit perfectly with the turn-of-the-century pop culture and vibes of that era. Complete with a stellar cast that includes Julia Stiles, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and of course the late, great, and forever missed Heath Ledger. This teen comedy is above its peers, in my humble opinion, and delivers a movie that is not only sharply written, but beautifully acted and frankly holds up now 25 years later, which is crazy to think about, everybody. Just hold that thought for a minute. 1999, this is another celebrated film from that year that turns 25, so raise a goblet for that right now. But in any event, that is going to be the topic of today's episode, 10 Things I Hate About You. And I am delighted, not that I hate this person, but I am delighted to welcome back Mr. J.J. Hodges. This is now his second time on the show. So J.J., welcome back to the show. And I'm looking forward to talking about this film with you today. And I want to point out that you were the one who brought it to my attention that this movie does turn 25 years old. I think it has, we've passed its milestone. I think it was back in March of 99 when it was released. So we're a few months after the fact, but nevertheless, no time like the present. So JJ, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, this is one of my favorite movies, and I kind of threw it out there to you, like, hey, you know, if you're thinking about it, it's no big deal. And I kind of don't know why I downplayed it, because literally there's nobody I talk to about this movie that goes, yeah, not a fan. You know, the it's either I love that movie or I haven't seen it. Right. You know what I mean? Right. And there's very few of the latter.
And no, I will just say at the start, I was late to the party with this film. Like I had seen bits and pieces of it over the years and, you know, obviously, you know, knew about it, but it wasn't until, I honestly want to say, it was like probably within the last maybe 5 or 6 years that I actually sat down and saw it from start to finish. And, you know, it was one of those movies going into, you sort of think, okay, is this going to live up to the hype that everybody has talked about? Because certainly, you know, many, many films have come out in this sort of genre or subgenre since then. But I was happy to say that it not only met expectations, but it outright surpassed and delivered on, mm-hmm. on all accounts. It's a marvelous film, absolutely marvelous film.
It really is, and I think it having kind of that Shakespearean, I guess for lack of a better word, text to have as its blueprint really helps with that. You know,
that's the thing. Like, it's funny, you know. Sort of was discussing this with somebody a few weeks back with Anyone But You, which sort of, again, another, I wouldn't call that a teen comedy, more of a, you know, traditional rom-com, mm-hmm. you know, sidebar, everybody starring Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney. But that also borrows heavily from a number of Shakespeare, you know, plays and whatnot. But, you know, this is sort of one of those interesting takes where it never feels forced, if I mm-hmm. can say that. Like, you know, again, I enjoyed Anyone But You, but, and that's just, you know, one example, but a lot of times these films that will borrow heavily from Shakespeare or sort of adapt for a modern audience feel a little too heavy-handed. This never feels like it's sort of like taking that, you know, play, if you will, and setting it in the modern era. Like it's borrowing moments, but it's not like a, and in your face. It doesn't beat you over the head with, okay, this is Shakespeare, but we're setting it in 1999.
Right.
Yeah, it's go ahead.
I think there was an Ethan Hawke version of Hamlet that was like modern day New York, but it was they spoke the script of Hamlet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's a little, you know, that's a little much, you know.
Because, I don't like that. Yeah,
and like I said, if you're gonna borrow from Shakespeare, like either do it as it were, or again, do like with what this film did, which was sort of almost make it a, I don't want to say it's an homage, but it definitely is more of a, in the spirit of Taming of the Shrew rather than a, you know, setting it in you know, 1999 and just, you know, changing right. the vernacular a little bit. But I mean, let's dive into it. So this movie, again, it takes the premise of the play, but like I said, does it with sort of the modern sensibilities. Basic premise of it is you have this, overprotective father of two girls, and he doesn't allow either of them to date, and introduce the character of Cameron, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is kind of, it's sidebar everybody, but it's sort of funny that, you know, you had two future Dark Knight alumni, if you will, in this film, kind of, you know, interesting to think about what was to come. But so he's in love with Bianca, and he's trying to, you know, get her to you know, go on a date with him, but like I said, the father has a very strict no dating policy, so he's, you know, the one catch is if the older daughter can find a date, then of course Bianca can date, and that's where all of the shenanigans fall into play, where we are introduced to, I guess you'd call him the bad boy, if you will, Patrick, mm-hmm. played by Heath Ledger. And again, it's sort of it's a case of, you know, opposites do attract, and it's just such it's a funny and at points absurd, but yet everything is played with such heart and tender care that you can't help but have like a great smile on your face by the end of this movie. Like I think of that scene when they're all in the on the field, and they're all doing their, like, it's like, I don't know, it's like a marching band prep or something, and then Ledger's character comes in and he does that song and dance number on the bleachers, and like that was a scene, as I said, like I had seen in bits and pieces over the years, but to like see that in the context of the movie, I mean, I was just like, I was rip roaring laughing, just having a great time with it.
It's such a great scene because you don't know what's going to happen.
No.
And even him kind of being chased around by the security guards, yeah. You know, is really fun. And it's such like it's such a movie thing, right? You know, where like when you're in high school, don't you just wish you could, oh, the girl I love, if I could just grab the mic and just sing out, you know.
Yep.
I think it's a Sinatra, Frankie Valli, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's I Love You Baby or something like that. I forget the song title, but.
And who knew? Like, I don't think he did much after that, but Ledger had a great voice. You know, he was a good singer.
I know. Again, multi-talented. I mean, I could do a whole episode just on Heath, but I mean, it's Yeah, it's one of those moments where it's clearly a teen comedy moment. But like I said earlier, this movie sort of rises above, you know, the kind of quote unquote tropes, if you will. I mean, certainly they're there in this film. Like, you know, you've got your prom scene, you've got, you know, the quote unquote lover's quarrel, if you will. And, the music moment, like, but it's, I don't know. There's such sincerity to this film that, like, you know, certainly films that have come afterwards definitely, you know, sort of follow in this movie's tradition. But there's sort of an idea of this one coming first in a way. Like, it's this one sort of set the bar for all the other, you know, teen comedies of the era. I mean, I think of films like a Cinderella Story, and even to a lesser extent, a movie like Mean Girls. Like, they're, it almost feels in a way they're sort of like hat tipping to 10 Things I Hate About You. And I think that just sort of speaks to this film's just sort of remarkable, you know, having its finger on the pulse of not only the generation at the time, but sort of what works in these kind of movies.
Well, I think it's what it does really well is that it doesn't, it plays with multiple styles of comedy a little bit. Yeah. There's a lot of slapstick. Mm-hmm. There's some genuinely funny bits. You know, there's the characters who are just basically lunatics living an everyday life, you know, like the, like Allison Janney's character.
Yeah, that's right.
She's only in three scenes, whatever it is. And she's, you know, she's a nutcase and it's hilarious.
He almost steals the show in a lot of ways.
You know, and I think it's almost like they knew that when they were editing. So they were like, we can't keep her in the rest of the movie. Yeah. Because Allison Janney's just, she's also just one of those, like, whenever you see her in something, it's like a welcome presence. Like,
Now you stop and take notice.
Yeah. And I think this whole cast, you know, for as young as they were at the time, most of them were child actors. So they were, in a weird way, this was almost like a transitional period from, like, the, you know, teenage stuff into the grown-up stuff.
Yeah.
But I really loved the way, I don't know, the actors are just so genuine in it. You know, like, when you have Allison Janney acting like a lunatic, flipping off the students, and you have Joseph Gordon-Levitt going, "What? Am I in the wrong office?" And she's like, "Okay, you're done now. Get out of here." You know, it's just, you know, the cast isn't just like, you know, goofing off and, you know, just whatever. There's sincere performances in it. Even when the situations are like super outlandish, you know, one of my favorite little bits in the movie is when, David Krumholtz is coming up to, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Heath Ledger, and he like mistimes him running over to them because the track team almost plows right through him. And he's like, "I'm sorry," you know, very like Kramerish. And then they're like, "Okay, so what's the news?" And it's like, "Well, we got to have this really silly bit and then get back into the story." I don't know. And it works, you know?
A lot of these, I mean, I'll be honest, I am not generally a fan of teen comedies. I just, because they sort of fall into the formulaic and are like, the characters are usually cutouts and there's no real story per se. I mean, like, you can pretty much guess what's going to happen based on the title or even sometimes like how the poster was set up.
Right.
That's not the case with this film at all. And I mean, one that actually I feel is like the closest to it. And again, maybe it's because I saw it first and then saw this film afterwards, but a movie like Easy A feels very much in this wheelhouse where, yeah, it's a quote teen comedy, but it's smart, it's funny, and the characters actually feel and act like real people, even though there might be outrageous things. Like, I mean, you know, Patrick is like, I mean, if you saw the guy in like real life or in school, you might be okay, maybe stay away from him. Like, there's something off there, but yet it all works within this world that they've created. And I think that's, again, it's sort of the attention to detail, whereas like in most of these, again, quote, teen comedies, there's sort of cardboard cutouts where it's like, all right, you're the jock, you're the, you know, the girl next door, you know, that's the quote, bad boy. And yet everybody here, even when there is a type like David Krumholtz, who's sort of like the geeky nerd character, there's an element of sincerity that exists in everybody. And even, like I said, Allison Janney, who's completely out of her mind in the movie, like, it works. I don't know, it just, everybody feels grounded. And even when the moments are so exaggerated, like, you know, even like the scene at the end where Kat is reading her you know, her poem, and it's like, you know, it's one of those like moments, like, oh, okay, it's a movie moment, but yet again, I think just the quality of the performances, nobody's phoning it in or even, you know, leaning into camp, if you will. And that sometimes, like, again, any number of these movies, whether it's like you know, Freaky Friday, for example, or you know, other movies of that, you know, genre, like, you gotta throw back a Cinderella Story, they sort of like play into the type. And this movie sort of smartly avoids all of those little pratfalls. And so, I mean, that was something I really appreciated because, like, you know, going into it, I was like, okay, you know, is it going to be just like another teen comedy kind of a thing? And it's
sure.
Again, there are those moments, but it's not like it rises to the occasion and it keeps that momentum going from start to finish. So like by the end, like, you know, spoiler alert, everybody, if you haven't seen it, but like when Kat and Patrick get together, I mean, I know, shocker, it happens in a comedy, but like, I know it just feels so earned and it's not like, it's not in your face. And in many ways, I almost think I was kind of surprised that it doesn't go like too soapy or too melodramatic as a lot of these things are like, it's very simple. Like, okay, like they get back together, like they, you know, confess their feelings for each other, but like, that's it. They don't have to beat you over the head with the, oh, let's show them in this shot, in this moment. Like it's very natural. And I think that's something that, again, a lot of other films that followed it, you know, again, I go back to Easy A is sort of a one that's outside the mold, if you will, that again, feels like, in many ways, it could be almost like a sister movie to this film, where it just sort of like is played for real. Even though there are laughs, there are, you know, sort of outrageous moments and characters, you buy into it because you bought into the story and into the universe.
That's what I always call. If you ever listen to my show, I say this all the time. That's what I call emotional reality. You know, like it doesn't. You know, like we're big, you know, like genre fans, right? You know, sci-fi, and, you know, last episode we talked about Spider-Man. You know, I know you're a big Dark Knight fan. So as am I, of course.
I know, right?
But it's, but even something as simple as the recent, you know, my buddy and I were just talking about this last night, X-Men 97. Like, if you can tell a wacky story, but if you have a really good emotional reality, then the audience will go along with it because, you know, and the whole, every movie is some form of heightened reality anyway.
Right, right.
The comedies, for sure, you know, you get, like I said, you get slapsticky stuff. You get a scene where, you know, they have the you know, they throw the flyers for the, you know, Bogey Lowenstein's party, right?
Yep.
And they go down this gigantic thing. They would get in so much trouble for that in real life.
But I was thinking about like how, I mean, I remember, you know, sort of a side tangent, but my class for our quote senior prank, someone decided it was a good idea to spray paint part of the grassy knoll near the parking lot and just, you know, spray painted into the grass, you know, class of 2010. Of course, I'm not confessing to anything here, everybody, but like, oh God, like, I mean, heads were rolling that day. I mean, it was like, oh boy, like they sat us all down the gymnasium and stern lecture about, you know, what you've done and graffiti the grass. And it's like, watching this, like, oh my God, like, you know, there would be like disciplinary actions, like threatens to withhold diplomas or something.
Yep. Yep. Well, especially because it's the flyers say like free beer,
you know? Yeah, I know.
And it's like,
they're not hiding it.
Yeah. They're all like 16 years old. But at the same time, that's the fun of some of these movies is that you can buy into their reality.
Yeah.
Because they're all selling it, you know, really well. And it was funny. I was thinking about this. You know, it's like this was the first time I ever saw Heath Ledger in anything. You know, it was, you know, but it was also like oddly familiar to have Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who was on 30 Rock.
Or
30 Rock. I knew I was going to do that. Third Rock from the Sun.
It's like
because I was thinking about that earlier. And I was like, not to be confused with 30 Rock, and then I just freaking said it. But then Larissa Olenek. Who I had a huge crush on when I was a kid from what's that show called? The Secret World of Alex Mack.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like, love that show.
Oh my gosh. And it's kind of, I think it's like lost to time. I don't even know if you could find it anywhere, maybe YouTube or something.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. Talk about a trip down memory lane.
There was, you know, and so I had this like huge crush on her and I think this was the first movie I ever saw Julia Stiles in. But either way, having some of that familiar familiar cast that I knew and some, you know, some new people. It just, it made for, you know, and Andrew Keegan, I think, has played every jerk in every show in every movie. Poor guy. He's probably a very nice guy, but, you know, he was always playing bully types in the 90s. So I knew some of them. I didn't know some, I knew some, I didn't, but it still helped it helps to sell the world. Like I said, you have this really great emotional reality. You have this really great chemistry with all the actors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was listening to, there's a Pod Meets World, which is the Boy Meets World rewatch podcast. Mm-hmm. That some of the cast does. And they interviewed Andrew Keegan and Larissa Olenek in separate episodes. And they mentioned 10 Things I Hate About You in both cases. And both of them were like, oh my gosh, it was so much fun. It was kind of like summer camp, you know, like we all became really close and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that's so cool to hear 25 years later, because they could easily just be like, oh, that movie, well, we had such a bad experience.
Right.
And you hear that plenty with successful movies, you know.
They couldn't wait to get away from each other.
Right. But, and so I thought that was cool that separately they had said that about their experiences. And it shows, you know, like.
That's the thing. You can tell this was not a phoned in performance. Like, there's genuine chemistry among the actors. Like, clearly everybody was having a great time with this. I mean, how could you not, honestly?
Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where I was probably. So 25 years ago, so I was like 12, maybe like 12, 13, when I first saw it. And so I was at kind of at the right age where I was like, I was like, oh my gosh, like this movie's hilarious. And it's one of those things where, you know, you revisit stuff from your childhood as you get older, and some of it still works, some of it doesn't. Some of it you're just like, yeah, I could still look past it because it's that important to my childhood or whatever. But this was one of those examples where, even as I'm getting older and like showing it to friends of mine that we're in our 20s, 30s, you know, and we're all laughing, we're all having a good time.
Yep.
There's no like, dude, I don't want to watch like a teenager movie. You know what I mean? Like it's themes and everything are a little bit more universal than that.
That's the thing. I mean, a lot of these kind of movies, like I've said, they sort of exist in a moment, but yet once that moment has passed, they fall out of style, and you go back and you're like, boy, this is really kind of cringy, or you just, I can see how that might've been at the time. This movie, no, like clearly it holds up, and there's a reason why, again, there's a reason why we're talking about it now, a 25-year-old film, it still works. And I think that is partly because it's of its moment. Like, hey, okay, you can tell this is the late 90s, early 2000s, but like even then, just the way the characters interact, like nobody feels, I'll say it again, like a broken record, but nobody feels like a stock character. Like everybody fits in this little world, whether it's the jock, whether it's Ledger's character, like everybody has their part, but it works. Like it's a seamless transition. And that's something that I have not seen replicated. Again, with the exception of, I mentioned Easy A, none of these, like they all tend to fall into that stereotype, and it's like, all right, another teen comedy, you know, I think that was a spoof movie or something like that,
right.
You know, and like this movie is not like it's smart, it's funny, and it's effective. Like you can't help but be caught up in it. Like a lot of times these movies, like, all right, it's almost like background noise. This is not like you don't want to take your eyes off the screen because you don't know what's going to happen. And you're so caught up in this. And that's something I can say rarely happens with me when I watch these kind of films. Like this is a very powerful, and again, it feels kind of funny saying like you're getting all this kind of emotion from like a teen quote unquote comedy, but yet that's the beauty of it. Like, again, you know, you can, you know, say that's a hat tip to Shakespeare, but like,
yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why we still talk about his work and those plays, and why these kind of films resonate with an audience, because it's something a little bit deeper than just another, quote, teen comedy.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, being, you know, men in our 30s talking about this movie, and really like unabashedly loving it, though.
That's the thing.
But I think what's you know, like the performances are all really solid, and yeah. You know, and especially, you know, because in those interviews I mentioned, especially I remember Larissa Olenek, they asked her specifically about Heath Ledger, and she said, "We all knew that he was going to be something special."
Yeah,
you know, and it's clear, like he, you know, I mean, they're all,
oh yeah,
you know, like you said, they're not phoning it in, but you know, what I had read was that after this movie came out, he was offered all sorts of similar parts and turned them all down and like took a year off of acting. Yeah. And then, you know, I don't remember what he did after. I know like A Knight's Tale came out a couple years later. And then of course there's that, I don't know, he was in some sort of, I think it was a Marvel movie, like played some sort of clown character. I don't know. It didn't do
that well. Yeah, it was interesting.
But you know, it was a, but you can, but it's strange to say, you know, because I didn't know him at all, but watching the movie, you get the vibe that it's like, man, this guy, like he just was on another level. Like,
yeah,
there's, you know, like this, the script was talking to him, you know, he is Patrick Verona and, you know, all the other actors are great and everything, but I don't know. There's just, and maybe it's just because of his character type, which I think he plays so well, which is he is the guy that everybody's afraid of. Everybody thinks, you know, like you were saying earlier, you know, there's all these rumors about him and what he does really well is he plays to that when he's at school. But as the characters talk to him and get to know him more, you can tell that he doesn't like that.
Right.
You know, like he's more sensitive than that. And he's trying to, you know, and he genuinely does fall for Julia Stiles, you know, for Kat.
Yeah.
And that was something on my last rewatch. I realized I was watching it going, they're doing a really great job of genuinely kind of falling for each other. Like I buy it in the movie, you know?
No, you do. And again, I think, you know, it's a testament to both of their skills as actors, but no, you buy it. There's something, there's a chemistry there. And like I said, with the way you watch Ledger, I mean, he's transfixing in the film. Like you can't help but see, okay, what the hell is he going to do now? Sure. Like there's that moment, like in the classroom when he, you know, lights up the cigarette. Like, I mean, that's an iconic scene right there of itself.
He plays with the flame, you know?
Yeah. It's like, okay, God, this guy's, he's on a whole other level, but yeah.
This
is a situation where I think in the wrong hands, like I'm always like cautious. Like, oh, you know, an actor, you know, makes whatever they're given. But like, this is a situation where I think like in the wrong hands, this could have been like a very weird or almost a standoffish character that the audience couldn't be invested in. I think it's a combination of Ledger's just charm and charisma as an actor and as a person, but then what he was able to do, like he's on another level in this movie. I mean, that's could be the case with any film that he was in throughout his short but beautiful career. And you just see it in this film, like he's somewhere else, and it works so magnificently. Like I said, you can't help but just be like, you know, what the hell is he going? Like, I mean, like you can do a whole spin-off show, you know, movie just on, you know, the adventures of Patrick and what, you know, he did before this movie.
Well, yeah, which he lays out, and maybe that would be kind of boring because he was taking care of his grandpa before he died. But you know, it helps that, you know, he's obviously, you know, one of the main characters. I mean, it's an ensemble, you know.
Yeah, so big time.
It, technically, the movie's about him, I guess. 10 Things I Hate About You, and it's him. But although I got to say, though, so this is like something only you would only know if you like lived through it, which is that the movie poster and like the video jacket had 10 Things I Hate About You. The U made an arrow pointing at Heath Ledger, right, pointing at Patrick. But the CD, the soundtrack, it was pointing to Bianca. And I remember my sister telling me that, like, she bought it, she was listening to it, which, by the way, that soundtrack still slaps.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. But, yeah. Yep.
And Nico, if you're listening, Caruso, I just said slaps for real this time. not ironically.
You get your points today.
I remember my sister saying that. She's like, yeah, so that's kind of weird. Maybe it's just the way the thing's spaced out. And it always bugged the hell out of me. Like, every now and then I think about it. It's like papyrus, right? You know, you just go, it's like, but it was pointing at her. It's not about her, you know.
I'm looking at it right now. So I could see how that could be irritating.
I've always been like a weirdly, there's my cat's tail on the camera.
That's all good.
excuse me. I've always been weirdly attuned to movie posters and merchandise and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, fun fact, I've never really told anyone this before, but I'm going to go ahead and say it on air.
All right.
The fact that the marketing for Batman 89 was just the logo has always annoyed the crap out of me. I wish we had gotten a poster that had the characters on it. Like, it's always sort of irritated me. When I was a kid, I would like draw pictures and see like, what, how could this look different? So,
well, we've broken news tonight. That you know, everybody put down your virtual pitchforks. No, honestly, hey, I respect that. You know, because it's—I tell you, not to get off on a tangent, but like, that's a poster that people sort of hold up as almost like a golden idol at this point. Where I've actually never heard of, and I wouldn't say you're like outright, you know, criticizing it per se, but like, you know, I've never heard the counter to that poster. So thank you for sharing that.
That's just, you know, it's just one of those like silly things. That, yeah. It's again, it's like a papyrus thing. Every now and then you think about it and just go, what were they thinking?
Why?
but anyway, getting back to the movie, you know, you have these really great performances, but they also have great arcs too. You know, like I said, with Verona's arc, him being, you know, just seeming like this, like, criminal, badass, whatever, don't talk to him, don't look at him. And then it turns out he's actually a really sweet, sensitive guy. And, you know, probably the turning point in the movie that where the arcs really start to collide is the party scene, right? Again, a teenage movie trope, but I think they're all pretty organic in this film. You know, it doesn't, you know, it's like, of course there's going to be a beer party. Of course there's going to be the prom scene. Of course there's going to be the makeup and kiss and whatever, blah, blah, blah. Which is, but it's none natural. Of it feels, yeah, and it's, you know, because there's probably three or four other movies you could point to and go, yeah, that one didn't do it as well. You know, right. Like there's a reason that, you know, 25 years later, I could go into work tomorrow and talk to somebody and be like, hey, you ever see 10 Things I Hate About You? And I'm certain any women my age would turn to me and go, oh my gosh, I love that movie.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I mean, that's the thing. This is a movie where I don't even know if you could make it today. You know, not that it's controversial by any means, but just there's a wonderful pacing to this film that I think would be completely turned around if somebody was to make it today or make a version like it would. You know, I can't honestly see a number of scenes in this film, you know, making it past the cutting room because they'd be like, oh, it's unnecessary. I could see someone saying, we don't need to do Heath Ledger's dance scene. You know, and again, those are moments that make this movie stand out. They're great moments for the characters. And again, it gives us just a more engaging story. And so like, I mean, this film does feel like a time capsule in a way to a forgotten era that, you know, cause like everything today, it's like, okay, if it doesn't move the plot along in 60 seconds, we cut it out. And it's like, that's how you get great character moments. And that there's so many in this particular movie, but we haven't even, you know, talked about Larry Miller's character. I mean, he's wonderful in every role you see him. And I actually just rewatched the Nutty Professor recently. And it's a small role. He plays the dean, but like, even in that, like he's always a standout. And you know, again, he's not the star of this film, but even he has a nice little arc in this movie. And again, he's the overprotective dad, but like,
yeah,
again, I sound like a broken record, but it's not the cliche. Like again, you can see where people saw this movie after the fact, like, okay, just do that and, you know, spruce it up here or cut it out there. But like,
sure.
There's something about this movie kind of setting the tone in a way, like everything feels organic. Like, I feel like today, like, you know, an overprotective dad character, you might cringe, but it works so well in this film. And again, I think that's, you know, that's a testament to Larry, who just sort of, yeah, he always has got like a zinger and just sort of even his cadence in a way, he just kind of finds a way to make, you know, even the most like, you know, banal line, you know, come alive and,
yeah,
and it can't help but make you laugh.
Well, you know, it's right up to the edge of like too much or cringy or whatever, but I think he's so funny and he's believable enough.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't know, because, you know, I think about, you know, when he's like outside exercising and it's such a goofy scene. And again, that's probably a scene that would get cut, like you were saying, if it was made today. But that scene is so, it doesn't move the plot along other than, you know, it's just Bianca pleading again, please let me go to prom, which again, somebody in an editing room would go, we already have this scene, we don't need it.
Yeah.
But because he is adding some physical comedy and he's saying just ridiculous, dorky dad stuff, like, you know, just, because I'll admit that my mom would say stuff like that. You know, it's like, I'm down, I got the 411. Like, my mom, like, you know, she would say goofy stuff like that, thinking that she sounds like we did, right?
Right.
And we
down with the kids.
Right. You know, it's like, no, mom, that's not how that works. And it's just, you know, it's just funny as hell having, you know, a character like that. But then you get the scene at, you know, towards the end when, you know, he has a really great heart to heart moment with Kat. And I think that whole runner, that arc of him being like, you know, go to school here so you're closer to home, it's never directly said. And I don't know if there's any deleted scenes. Maybe it was a first draft thing. But you don't really know what happened to their mom other than she left at some point.
Yeah.
And so knowing that, it makes his character make a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Why he pushes back against, you know, Kat wanting to leave. But then ultimately when he goes up to her and at the end is like, you know, you're grown up. I have to deal with this, you know? Right. And again, rewatching it very recently with, you know, now as a dad, I'm like blubbering at this scene going, you know, oh my God, like, wow. Like I never realized, you know, maybe it's just you with the parent eyes on, but I never realized how really beautiful that scene is and how well performed it is. You know, even just something as simple as like, she hugs him at the end and he doesn't know what to do. So he just kind of taps her arm, you know? But it's beautiful. You know, it totally works.
No. And again, that's a testament to his skills as an actor, where he can do the comedy, he can do the physical stuff, but then when you need to bring it home with some heart, he's there. Like, again, this is another situation where in the wrong hands, like, the dad would be kind of either over the top too much. He finds that perfect balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that scene, I mean, you can't help but have the heartstrings pulled by the end of it.
Well, and another thing I like about it is sort of the hilarity of, he makes this rule thinking it's this unbeatable rule.
I know.
And then when they find a way around it, he's like, well, he kind of begrudgingly is like, okay, go, right. You know, like it, you know, he lets them go to the party, lets them go to prom. And that really makes me laugh thinking like, you know, he still could have been like, no, I changed my mind. We're not doing that. You know, right. But I think it sells sort of the humor of the movie that the dad was just like, well, I'm not going to win this one. You know, so he lets the kids get away with it. I mean, not get away with it because, you know, they follow the rule, right? But you know what I mean? It's just kind of funny to think about, like, he's sort of hoisted on his own petard and he's kind of pissed off about it the rest of the movie.
Stone hard logic right there.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just, no, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, that's another point. Like, the dynamic between the three of them, it's so pitch perfect. Like, again, I sound like a broken record, but like so many of these movies where it's just like, okay, parent, child, like everybody has the role, like they come across as a real family. And again, I think that's something that this film never forgets. It's those small, tender moments. Like even when, like, you know, Kat and Bianca are just sort of like, you know, talking amongst themselves, like you, I know it, they just, it comes across as like a sisterly bond. And yeah. Like, there's moments of like, I want to call it like the overt drama, but like it's, I mean, again, this is still like a comedy, but there's like moments where like, yeah, this is some really powerful stuff here.
Yeah. Well, it's great because the story just works. Like the script mm-hmm. sort of figures it's asking questions that mm-hmm. we didn't know we wanted answers to. Why do Kat and Joey hate each other? Mm-hmm. We find out, you know, what happened to Patrick? What's the true story? You know,
yep.
We find out, you know, it's the movie, but it also lets all that stuff happen kind of naturally too.
Right. There's nothing, I've said it before. There's nothing, they don't beat you over the head with yep. this. Like everything arrives at its natural point, which is, again, I think this, you know, I mean, this is a critique of like, you know, modern movies in general, where there's like almost this need to like spoon feed you everything by the, like, you know, the final, you know, 10 minutes of the third act, where it's like just letting things play out and letting the characters dictate the story as opposed to the story dictating to the characters. And I yep. think a lot of times, particularly in these kind of movies, that's why I think for me personally, they always tend to fall flat, is it's just sort of like, it's style over substance. And yep. that is not the case with this movie. I mean, again, there's the flashy moments, but there's sure. so much heart there. And it's always leading with, what are the characters doing? Like you said, it's answering questions. We find out about what happened between Kat and Joey. We find out what happened with Patrick and his path, like it passed. You see characters go through these, you know, these wonderful arcs and transitions. Like, again, even like, you know, Bianca, she goes from like, I'm going to call her like a little princess at the start, but she's sort of like, you know, sort of like that spoiled, you know, brat mentality. Like, and she sort of, you know, she blossoms by the end of it. Like everybody has that natural evolution. And again, it's sort of like, you know, for, you know, a dynamic you might see in your own family or with your own friends even.
Sure. And I think that's what, that's what helps to sell it, is that they call attention to it again. Very like the Bogie Lowenstein party is a great example, mm-hmm. right? It's really great cinematic storytelling because all the characters get to be in one place.
Right.
And they all kind of learn something that they don't want to learn in that scene, or, you know, or are challenged in some way, right? I'm, you know, that's script writing, isn't it? You got to challenge your characters. But you know,
you pass the test.
Right. And you have this really great, and you get these really great moments where, you know, Patrick and you know, he drives Kat home and she tries to kiss him and he's like, no, not today. You know, which I just always remember as a kid feeling like, you know, on that tangent for a second, feeling like she was being such a jerk in that moment, like, what the heck? And then like, as I got older, I was going, oh no, wait, she is being a jerk. Like that wasn't just me being a stupid boy. No, he was in the right. He didn't want to just take advantage of her.
Right.
You know, and she got angry at him and I was like, and you know, it all works out, of course, but,
oh, yeah.
But at the same time, watching that scene, you see how what goes through his head and what goes through her head, mm-hmm. you know, and why she stays mad at him and what he's and how he kind of reconciled it. And then right after that, you get Bianca and Cameron pulling up and he just like lays into her like, what the hell? I did all this. And, you know, you treat me like garbage. And what's great is that she kind of realizes it in the moment, like, oh, wait, I have been a jerk and he has been a nice guy. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of a, I don't know, in both instances, it just, it works so well. And there's a reason that those scenes have stuck with me my whole life, right? You know, it's like, wow, they're well performed and there's nuance there. It's not just like, hey, we're going to kiss. Oh, no, we're not. Like, you know, and it's also not played for laughs. He's like, oh, your breath smells like puke. Get out of here, you know? Like, yeah. Neither one of them are played for laughs. They're these genuine moments. And then, you know, you get the great line, which I never really got until I got older. It's like, you know, later when Patrick and Cameron are talking, he's like, you know, she kissed me. He's like, where? He's like, in the car. That always made me laugh because I was just like, because as I got older, I was like, oh my God, am I Cameron? Is that how I would react? And someone would look at me like, that's not what I meant, idiot. But, you know, but again, very, very sincere moments that put this movie above just a teen comedy. Like there's genuine emotion and storytelling going on here.
Those are probably some of my favorite, if not my favorite parts of the whole film, just that whole dynamic. I mean, it's a wonderfully written scene, but just what they bring to it, just sort of, again, you said it elevates it in such a way above the usual sort of, you know, garbage that sometimes is shoveled in these kind of movies. I know I sound, you know, like a great critic here, but no, I mean, it's sort of funny. I mean, I saw this film much later on. And so like, it was sort of funny to watch those, you know, various scenes and sort of like, you know, you have flashbacks like to your own time in high school and like, you remember like, okay, wow, you know, role reversal here. And like, okay, you know, I was in this person's shoes. Like it was kind of enjoyable to look at it on that level, especially, you know, I mean, by the time I, you know, finally saw this film from start to finish, it was like, you know, 10 years after high school. So it was a unique experience to look back on everything and sort of, you know, you have that sort of, you know, twinge of nostalgia and just sort of like, you know, again, it's a wonderful love letter in a way to that time where you literally think you know everything and you really don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also what sells the movie is focusing mostly on the kids, you know, like there's really only like three adult characters, right? You know, there's Allison Janney, there's Larry Miller and Mr. Morgan. That actor's name escapes me. The English teacher who he's freaking hysterical in the movie.
Daryl Mitchell.
Yes, he's fantastic. But you know, I mean, he was, you know, in a bunch of 90s stuff too.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, you know, but again, there's also the coach too. So, you know, so again, there's very few like adult quote unquote characters, but I think that's what helps film because we get to just focus on our core ensemble.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like, again, today you'd have the necessary quote adult character who would simply be there to, you know, hand out pearls of wisdom and not even be a character, just sort of like a stand-in or a sounding board. Like I like it that it's really in, you know, the kids' world. This is it's not, you know, them sort of, you know, going up against adulthood, even though they're all on the cusp of it. It's like this is their world in this time of their lives, and they're figuring it, you know, they're figuring out shit as it goes along. It's not like someone's there to spoon feed them advice. You know, there's not the wise old teacher. Like, I mean, like, sure, you know, Larry Miller gets a few, you know, points, but it's a kid's, you know, it's a teen movie. I like that. It respects it enough to not be like, we're not going to dole out all the answers. We're not going to necessarily, you know, bring in the sage elder who's going to, you know, impart, you know, this is what happens in the real world, everybody. Like it knows its place, I guess is what I would say.
Well, and I think that's what sells the movie so well is not having that like guidance counselor, you know, give the right advice at the right moment or something, you know, and it's all character based and it moves the story along, but it's interesting to have that, you know, where it's it's the kids that figure everything out, that have to
right.
go through all the stuff. And it's also highly mundane stuff, right? You know, but
oh yeah, no, this is not, you know, end of the world type dilemmas yeah. here, you know.
Yeah, this is not, it's not life or death or anything.
No,
but,
we're not
but,
no.
But when you're that age and you
it is the end of the world.
Yeah. And I think that they all sell that really well. And I think Larissa Olenek, you know, especially, you know, just I think she pulls off being kind of the, you know, the sweet princessy, you know, like you know, ugh, like we all knew somebody a little prissy.
We
like
all knew
that.
Someone like her, yeah.
But yeah. But I think she's also so charming and cute that you it kind works. Of forgive her for it. And also later when she kind of, you know, drops the selfishness, it
yeah.
works. You know, it but it also feels organic. It doesn't just feel like test audiences didn't like this. We got to figure this out. You know what
no,
I mean?
No, this does not. Again, so many movies today feel like they are made in a boardroom. This movie is clearly not. And right. like, just sort of, you know, in prep for our talk today, I rewatched it because I just wanted to sort of be, you know, sort of soak it all in again. And mm-hmm. I mean, it just, it's a cliche to say it. They don't make them like this anymore. They really yeah. don't. And I mean, I guess like, you know, you can't always, like, you're always in search of that impossible last best thing. But there's again, there's a reason why we're talking about this film tonight, and so many other films in this genre have gone by the wayside and will be lost to history because sure. they just lack that magic spark that this film has. And it's, mm-hmm. and again, just rewatching it. I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, like this is a classic. I mean, I don't even think that's an overstatement in saying that this is a certified classic. It goes beyond the label of a teen comedy, as far as I'm concerned.
I 100% agree. And what works really well about it, you know, you mentioned, you know, we talked, you know, you mentioned about the costumes and everything. So the wardrobe gives it away immediately that this is like late 90s,
oh, yeah.
2000s. Even the soundtrack really does.
You know? I know, yeah.
Very like girl punk rock stuff, you know, that,
yeah.
you know, there's still stuff like that around. And, you know, I still love the soundtrack, but it, that was very much of its time. And
oh yeah.
But I would say that the story itself, the film itself is fairly timeless, you know, like
oh, yeah.
I, you know, you mean you notice that there's, you know, no cell phones or, you know, social media or whatever.
Right.
But it, you know, there's a charm to it that mm-hmm. makes me really love it going like, I forget all that watching it. Right. I'm not sitting there going, oh, that's right. This is a 25-year-old movie, you know, like
exactly.
It's yeah. it, no, you know, you, subconsciously, you know, but it doesn't matter. You know, the story sells itself.
That's the thing. You buy into it. Again, there's not a cell phone in sight. Like
right,
it's,
right.
Again, it's certainly of its time, but that's, again, another one of the charms about it is it's in that time. It's forever in that moment. And it's kind of fun to revisit that and just sort of
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
get lost in that world. And I mean, like you said, the story is, you know, old as time. So, you know, you can that's going to work. And I think that's part of the reason why this film holds up. This isn't like a, oh, so-and-so post something on social media and, oh, the, you know, Facebook photo blows up. So that's creating the, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's none right, of that. Right. Like, oh, did you check out Patrick's Instagram page? Like, it just, there's none of that. Like, it's, you know, it's, again, that certainly, you know, would feel dated and certainly, you know, more like a sore thumb. And again, mm-hmm. it's the beauty of the story that I think kind of, again, there's a reason why we're talking about it.
Right, right. And I will say that the oh my gosh, what was I going to say? Like it doesn't another thing that holds up really well. I can't really think of any like jokes that don't land in like a 2024 setting. You know what I mean?
No,
there maybe there's one or two, but for the most part, like
none come to mind. No,
yeah, there's I you know. I'm not sitting here going like, well, that was kind of, well, that's kind of cringy now or something. Cause you know, I mean, how many movies that are oh, this yeah. old or even slightly more recently, like Mean Girls does have some cringe parts to it.
Right.
But you know, but this one, it just, and that's sort of what I've realized about comedy and why I think there's, you know, what makes a successful comedy is, you know, I can't, you know, not to get like topical or political or whatever. Excuse me. Oh my gosh. I absolutely hate the idea of like, oh, you know, this person got canceled. Everything's woke and blah, 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 blah. Drives me absolutely insane. Cause it's like, you know, there's funny stuff you can do or say that doesn't, you know, that isn't mean spirited or doesn't,
right,
or isn't an innuendo or whatever. Things can just be funny, just to be funny, not to push the envelope, not to cause controversy, not to get people thinking or whatever. You know, it's like some right comedians want to do.
No, I mean, no, you raise absolutely valid points, because there's that kind of comedy, and I almost shudder to even call it comedy, because it's more just like, you know, insult it in your face. And like I said, it's meant to cause, you know, provoking reactions. That stuff immediately feels completely dated. Like you could, you know,
yeah,
timestamp it, you know, date and, you know, exact moment. And it's sort of forever etched in that moment and that particular, sure, point. You know, that's in a lot of ways is lazy writing to me. That's lazy comedy, mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm, you know, not to go down a rabbit hole, but like, you know, anybody can like, you know, poke fun at whoever's president, like, and oh, ha ha. But like in 5 to 10 years, like it's almost like, okay, well, it's not funny anymore. Cause you know, time has marched on. Whereas like, if you have a, you know, a well-written joke or even just sort of, you know, playful banter, like, if it's smart and if it's effective, it doesn't have to be nuanced. It doesn't have to be sort of layered. If there's sort of genuine heart behind it and sort of, you know, creative passion, not just, oh, well, this will get so-and-so riled up, or, right, you know, this will, right, be topical. Like it works so much better, I think. And again, that's the kind of stuff that lasts forever in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, again, not to go down like, you know, other rabbit holes, but like you can look at, you know, comedians like, you know, Rodney Dangerfield or even like a Don Rickles. Like there's sort of like a timelessness to those kind of people where, like, you know, yeah, probably no one would make those jokes today, but like it's sort of they got away with it because there was that sincerity behind it, that sort of that, you know, they weren't doing it to like, oh, I'm going to make a point here, or, you know, going to, you know, check a box here. Like it's sort of, it comes from, quote, the heart, if you will. And I get, mm-hmm, that sort of what I feel from, you know, this film, to sort of tie it back to topic, like, yeah, everything is coming from the heart. It's not like, again, clearly no one's like, oh, well, how are people going to react in, you know, 50 years when they watch? Like if it's sincere and it's all in good fun, it's going to last, and it's going to always be timely, if you will, because those experiences and those reactions are universal. I mean, mm-hmm, again, this, I mean, not to get really, you know, deep with it, but like, you know, this film sort of like touches on like that, you know, human condition aspect that is not often associated with these kind of movies. And again, I think that's why it continues to resonate and just pack such an emotional and hilarious punch. I mean, like I said, I rewatching it, I mean, I just big smile on my face, yep, you know, laughed. Yep. I mean, just like you just feel good. Like it's a damn good feel good movie.
Yeah. And I think it does exactly what it sets out to do. It's like, bingo, here's this moment in time where you're young and you don't know anything, but you think you know everything, and you're falling in love at first sight, and you do anything for this girl. And there's that heightened reality, but the emotional reality really sets in. And that's what, and you know, and I think that's what sells it. That's why we're, you know, we can talk about it so many years later, why you didn't watch it as a kid, but you're, right, watching it as an adult going, oh my gosh, I get it. You know, so you kind of retroactively are like, yeah, oh, I, yep, I've been there.
You, oh, know? No, seriously. Yeah.
And, yep, and then, you know, you, cause this film could, you know, very easily have been like a, you know, I don't know, like John Hughes was kind of the master at it. Right. You know, just,
yeah,
because it takes all the kids seriously. right? You know,
it treats them as people. It doesn't treat them as cardboard cutouts or like you're the kid role. Like, again, there's a reason why, you know, just to go on the John Hughes thing, like all those characters in, like, you know, Breakfast Club or you know, 16 Candles or, you know, even something as, you know, silly and out there as, you know, Uncle Buck, like they're treated like real people. They're not, you know, cutouts or stick figures. Like there's genuine heart and soul to each of them. And I think that's why, again, those movies are frankly timeless. And there's a reason why this movie has that timeless feel, because you're treating it with that sincerity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have to ask you, did you ever watch the, I guess there was a TV show that came out years later. I never saw it, but in doing some research for it, I discovered that there was a quote spinoff or like reimagining that came out. I want to say it was like around 2010, I believe. It did not last long. Like we're talking 2008, excuse me. It premiered in 2009. It lasted 20 episodes. So again, I throw that out there. Did you ever catch the 10 Things I Hate About You TV show that aired on, let me just get R, on the ABC Family?
I watched one episode. I don't remember like why. I was at a friend's house, and I think it like came, was like, next up is 10 Things I Hate About You, and they were like, oh, they made it into a TV show. I couldn't tell you what episode it was. They're like, do you want to watch this episode with me? And I was like, sure. And I thought it was god awful. Like, it just, it was sort of in name only. Like, they did exactly what you're saying the movie didn't. It kind of turned everybody into a caricature.
Interesting.
And I didn't care for that. Like, Cameron was really kind of like the wussy one, and Kat was more of a bitch. Like, not like I don't know. Julia Stiles still has some. She's got like, she's like bitchy, but she's not. It's not so like groan inducing, I mean, unbelievable. You know what I mean?
Well, she's the shrew character. But right, again, right, in the wrong hands, that's. Or I should say, you know, someone that's sort of leaning into an archetype, or again, putting something before character. I could see how you could arrive at that.
Yeah, and but it's but again, she toes the line really well. You know, the only character that's kind of irredeemable in a quote unquote is Joey, and you know, he's like the bully character, but at the same time, like, we don't really want, at the time, you know, nowadays, that character would have some sort of redemption arc.
Oh, sure, but, sure.
But back then, it was just like, no, this kid just needs to get punched in the face. And that's what happens.
That was a character arc in and of itself. You know, that was
closer. Exactly. Yeah, and it's, and again, having kind of that great, you know, kind of female empowerment moment, the damsel saves herself, whatever, you know. You know, she's the one that beats him up and takes him down. And again, I like that the movie doesn't make a big deal about that like,
right,
oh, he got beat up by a girl or something like that. You know, it's just like his teacher just makes fun of him later and that's about it. You know,
exactly. Again, it doesn't beat you over the head in this film. You know what I mean? Like, I feel, again, modern movies today, there would probably be like 30 different endings before you get to the, you know, reunion of Kat and Patrick, and like,
sure,
again, there's just sort of that simplicity that this film has that, you know, again, I mean, there's a reason why I don't, you know, often watch these kind of films, because they're trite and they're boring and they're overly predictable. And certainly, you know, I mean, you know, this is a teen comedy at its heart, and so you kind of know where it's going to go, but you're so invested in the characters that, you know, you don't mind going along for this ride. Whereas, like,
right,
you know, any other, you know, you pick out any Netflix film, and it's like, okay, you know, I can guess the resolution, you know, before the credits start.
Right, right. And I think that's a testament to the writing and everything, that, you know, they could have easily gone the less predictable route and mm-hmm. had them not get together, but they're still friends or something, whatever. But you know, the movie, you know, it gives them the happy ending. And I think,
yeah,
I don't know, in a day and age where it's like the, you know, we can't just have the happy ending. There has to be a subversion of expectations or yeah. whatever. You know, even in the most recent animated Garfield film, which I saw with my daughter, I was like, you know, did I don't want to. He did not go. No. But the kiddo, she thinks of herself as enough of a cat that she was cat enough for everybody. You know, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but also, you know, save your money. It's, you know, they do predictable things in it, but they try to subvert your expectation of the predictability of it. And it just, and when movies nowadays try and do it, it just reeks to me.
It just reeks
yeah. of,
yeah.
you know, well, we can't just give the character a happy ending. We have to have some twist in that happiness or something. Or, you know, or we were going to give the happy ending if it's not a kid's movie like Garfield.
Right.
And, you know, we're not going to give them the happy ending, but it's still a sweet ending. It's a bittersweet ending. And sometimes I'm just like, you know, and it's always my argument for Dark Knight Rises. I'm like, you know, when people push back on it, my argument is always, isn't it okay that the heroes get a happy ending? Let's just let this Bruce Wayne just have his happy ending, you know?
I am so glad that you said that, because I'm actually, you know, spoiler alert, everybody, I'm doing an episode later this summer that is going to be just about that whole point on endings. And that is my biggest issue with sort of modern Hollywood, if you will. They don't know how to end a movie. Like,
yes.
Just end the damn thing. Sometimes it's okay to end a movie, to tie up the loose threads, to give the characters a happy ending. Oh, I preach, brother. Preach.
And I think, you know, some things don't need that. Some things right. don't. It's the twist is what makes it work.
Oh, sure. Again, depends on the film. Exactly. Genre. Absolutely.
Right. But, you know, it just feels like nowadays it's like there's like this mandate of some sort of third act twist.
Oh, no. I feel whatever. Like today, if you, again, made this movie, you know, Patrick would probably, you know, either get hit by a bus or something and be in a body cast for the, you know, credit reel or like, you know, Kat would decide, oh, I'm leaving you and I'm so unhappy with life. Like, I mean, I just feel like there would be too much extra emphasis to be like, okay, let's just nix the happy ending, because, you know, that's what they are expecting. So we're going to really subvert you and then subvert you again.
Well, you know, but there's something to be said about you watching the movie, having a big smile on your face. How could you not?
Yeah.
And even just kind of the very sincere ending of they're going to be okay.
Yeah. You know? I don't need to know anymore.
Yeah. This story is over. And then even having kind of the fun of the camera pans up and the band is playing on the roof.
Right.
Like, it's like, just like, this is fun.
Thank
this
you.
Stuff doesn't, you know.
It's a movie, folks.
I rewatched School of Rock recently.
Oh, that's a good film.
I forgot that's how that movie ended, with them in the his little makeshift studio singing and stuff. And I was like, and I kept watching the credits because of it. I was like, well, this is far more interesting than waiting around for, you know, Blade to show up at the end of the next Marvel movie to be like, I'm going to be in the next movie next summer. Exactly. You know? And then it's just like, you know, I'm super guilty of sitting through all those.
Oh, sure. No, yeah.
But there's something to be said about having the end credits be something that's fun to watch before we get to like the tease of the next thing. John Hughes actually did a lot of post-credit scenes.
No, Ferris Bueller is a great example of that. You know,
the very end,
what are you waiting for? It's over. Go home.
And you know what's funny about that? On that tangent for a second, I remember going to see Deadpool with my best friend, and I turned to him and I was like, dude, what if the post-credit scene was like Ferris Bueller? And then that's what happened. He shows up and goes, you're still here? And he was like, dude, you knew that. I was like, I didn't. I swear to God. Like, but it hit me. I'm like, this is Ryan Reynolds. Like,
yeah.
he's going to do, it's going to be a Ferris Bueller bit.
Yeah.
So I was not surprised by that. But it was just funny to be like, wouldn't that be funny if that happened? And then, of course, it did. And then I'll never live down the, you knew that. Like, I actually really didn't, I promise.
You had clairvoyance to the movie right there.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, you know, it's, there's something, you know, it's like, this is a good example of the movie doesn't need to be all twisty and weird or push the envelope. It can just be fun in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of automatically became a classic in its own right.
Right.
You know, and it's, a lot of movies don't do that. A lot of movies, I mean, how many movies come out a year? And
exactly. They're,
and even worse nowadays with Hulu and Apple and Netflix and all that other shit. But, you know, it, and sometimes you just, you know, I just want to sit down and watch a really good movie that I could recite to you right now.
Right.
But that's all I need. I don't need it to be anything wacky or crazy or, you know, have this big third act reveal that, you know, Joey is Kat's long lost brother or something, you know, like, no, it could just like the reveal is she finds out that there is this bet going on and she's understandably furious about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost better than any sort of twist because then, you know, you watch the movie and go, well, I wouldn't forgive him. Is she going to forgive him? Like, what's going to happen? The movie's not over yet, you know? And again, like the movie was smart about that. It's let's kind of tense the audience up that maybe this won't work out, but then it does. You know?
Yeah, no, again, that's sort of the beauty of it, where it's you're so invested in the world and in the character's journey that you know you sort of consider all of the obstacles and options before the very end. Like, I mean, that's. In one of those moments, I mean, I remember the first time I watched, I'm like, oh, maybe they don't actually. Maybe this is one of those movies where it's going to be kind of bittersweet at the end where, you know, they'll part friends, but that'll be the end of it. So, you know, but I mean, obviously it you know, delivers that happy ending. But again, the movie, you're invested so much by that point that you're willing to sort of go along with whichever direction they end up taking. And that's not something that, you know, a lot of these movies do very well or even at all. And even as the case, you know, in sort of other genres, like being able to have that confidence to sort of take the audience on an emotional roller coaster, if you will, where like, you know, you're playing in your head, like all the different possibilities and scenarios and what if moments. And then finally reaching, you know, that moment that you know, we all want deep down, but then it sort of is, you know, even more satisfying because we've gone through the rigors of like, okay, you know, will they, won't they kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah. And it's really, and it's just, I don't know, you know, we've talked for like an hour about how great a movie is and, you know, it is nuanced. It is layered. It's interesting, but more than anything, it's just fun. It's entertaining. It's a fun movie. You know, that's all it needs to be. But it sets itself apart, like you said, from these other teen movies because it's taking everything seriously because the emotional reality for the characters is this is serious. This is really happening to us.
Yep.
And that's what sells it as opposed to just being what adults think teenagers do.
Bingo.
Or whatever, you know what I mean?
No, I mean, the folks who wrote and directed this film, they actually – They were teenagers. Like, this wasn't someone trying to, like, what would a teenager, like, you know, I mean, you can really feel the sense of experience, you know, a lived experience as opposed to just sort of composites. Again, it's a brilliant film and there's a reason it holds up. Before we tie this, put a bow on this one, who's your favorite character in the film? That's a loaded question. Because everybody has such a role in this film.
I'd probably just give it to Michael, to David Krumholz's character.
Oh, okay.
Cause he just gets some of the funniest lines in it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know why, but it's like in my brain now that repeating something is really funny. So like, at the one point when Ledger storms off and he comes up to, to Cameron. He's like, don't say shit like that to him. People can hear you. You know, it just, that's like stuck in my head. So every now and then, like when I want to like mess with my friends or something, like I'll just repeat something they said. You know, I do it to my sister all the time, and it pisses her off, but I think it's hilarious. there's not a bad character in the bunch, but he has some of the best lines in it. And I just kind of like how kind of goofy he is, especially considering characters he'd later play. Like in Superbad, he's this like really like dick, like, you know, he's only in the one scene. He's like, I want to see a fight, man. I'm just like, oh my God, that's Michael, you know?
he's a wonderful actor. He elevates any film in any role, big or small. Absolutely. Yeah. I would co-sign. He's a memorable character. I love Allison Janney. She's really almost a scene stealer in this entire film. I got to give it to Heath. I mean, it's just something, just incredibly memorable about this role. And just, again, in such a short career, but just all of the roles that he played. I mean, there were so many. Like, I mean, they're all standouts in many ways. And that's just a testament to what a phenomenal actor he was. But,
I had made a joke a long time ago, a friend of mine, where I said something about, I think this must have been right after, or close to The Dark Knight, I guess, or Dark Knight Rises, I should say. Because I remember like telling somebody, I was like, I feel like Christopher Nolan watched 10 Things I Hate About You and was like, I'm going to cast some of these people. Some of these people are great, you know, because a lot of them have gone on to do Nolan movies.
I know, David Cronin.
And I remember, and I said that to somebody I just met. I was with a friend, and this was her roommate. And she's like, wait a minute. Did you just say Christopher Nolan directed 10 Things I Hate About You? And I was like, no, I said, I think he watched it. And she was like, oh, and we all started laughing. And I was like cracking up thinking about it, going like, and like, what would that movie look like? Christopher Nolan's 10 Things I Hate About You.
You know, I mean, that's a hypothetical right there. You know, I mean, sidebar, he is a fan of La La Land. So, you know, he does, he might have it in him. You know, maybe that's the next movie.
You know, I wouldn't bet against him, you know.
No, I never bet against Nolan, that's for sure.
Yeah, but you know, I always thought that
that's funny.
I always think of that, and one time when I was watching the movie and I was not sober, I posted a picture of Heath Ledger and I said, did you know, trying to make it all sound official, that Christopher Nolan cast Heath Ledger as the Joker because of the scene at Bowie Lowenstein's party in 10 Things I Hate About You. And I don't think anybody believed me. I think anyone who saw that tweet saw right through me and was just like, all right, well, JJ's on, he's on one of his kicks again. But, you know, but I thought it was very funny. And then because I read it the next day after I took some Advil and such, and I was like, pretty funny, actually.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Drunk tweeting. Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very clear if you read some of my tweets, like, when the stuff kicks in.
Right.
But that's a discussion for another day.
No, that's we'll save that for the Patreon episodes.
There we go.
No, absolutely, folks. You can get in on that action. No, I'm just kidding. Well, JJ, this has been an absolute delight. And I really do want to thank you for reminding me that this movie turned 25 years old, because I sound like a broken record again, but it's a classic, you know. To quote Spike from Notting Hill, another movie with a 25-year plate in its corner, absolute classic, as he says in the film, and that is that's how I feel about this movie. It is it's timeless. So thank you for coming back on the pod and talking about it. But where can folks find you and stalk you ever so kindly on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Four Comic Junkies. That's F-O-R Comic Junkies. You can also follow at Spider-Man Books, which is for the podcast, the Spider-Man Book Club that I host, and possibly get Phil on pretty soon for a spider movie themed extravaganza coming up.
Let me know.
I think that's it. Instagram for Comic Junkies. Mostly on Twitter, just because I love to, throw out those wacky thoughts every now and then, because maybe one day I'll end up on a BuzzFeed article that says funniest tweets about blah, blah, blah.
Follow JJ for drunk tweets. There we go. That should be the slogan. Yes. There we go. It all serves as all the information, guys, will be in the show notes. And I would encourage you to give this man a follow and to have a listen to his shows, because they do good stuff over there. And especially if you are a fan of Spider-Man and sort of the Spider-Man comics, they're not just sort of surface level discussions. You guys really get into the details of everybody's friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. So
that emotional reality, man.
That's right. That's right. And certainly, everybody, you can find I'll leave all the information as usual in the show notes. But JJ, again, want to thank you for coming back onto the show, and I'm sure I'll have you back sometime real soon, and we'll have another. Love another discussion about another timeless classic movie or just maybe an open-ended discussion about movies in general.
I'm always down for movies. My best friend and I, we play the game Name That Movie. We just did it yesterday, actually, throwing out some quotes. And we try to make them as obscure as possible.
Nice.
We've ever kept score. But if I had to keep score, I'm certain he'd be winning.
Okay. All right.
Not by much. Right. But if there's like 10 right answers, I'm pretty sure I'm at 9.
So. Okay. All right. Real coin toss here. All right. I like that.
Maybe, you might say it differently, but.
No. That's right. Truth is subjective, apparently.
Exactly.
Definitely. We'll have to maybe do something with that down the line. But, any event, thank you as always for being on the show. And thank you to the folks at home for watching or listening to this show. That does it for me today. I'll be back next week, and we will certainly do this all over again for the love of movies.
Copyright material used or referenced in this show belong to the rightful owners and is made possible by the Fair Use Act. Thank you for listening to Phil at the Movies.